was elected in 2016, but the sidelining of science-based recommendations in policy decisions has only accelerated since. Against the advice of researchers, Donald Trump announced plans in 2017 to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord, an international accord to fight global warming. He claimed the pact would devastate the economy without providing much environmental benefit. His administration has since rolled back more than 100 environmental protections it deemed burdensome to industry, including those seeking to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Donald Trump has also appointed industry insiders, or climate change doubters, to key roles overseeing environmental regulation, and cut scientific advisory committees at federal agencies. The politicization of science has come into sharper focus this year amid the coronavirus pandemic, as President Donald Trump has ridiculed and ignored many research findings and recommendations from the administration's top infectious disease expert, Anthony Fauci, and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. We now present you an article written jointly by Valerie Volkovici and Sharon Bernstein. The piece is titled, Make Science Great Again, U.S. Researchers Dream of Life After Trump. The article has been taken from the Reuters News Agency website. Please stay with us for more of Valerie Volkovici and Sharon Bernstein's article. From his laboratory in Toulouse, France, Benjamin Sanderson models the range of extreme risks to humans from climate change, research he hopes can inform policymakers planning for worsening wildfires and floods. It is the kind of work he once performed in the United States and hopes to again soon. Benjamin Sanderson is among dozens of US-based climate scientists who shifted their research to France, or sought refuge in academia or in left-leaning states like California after Republican President Donald Trump was elected in 2016. They worried his administration's distrust of science would impact their ability to finance and advance their work. Now, with the presidential election looming and Democrat Joe Biden ahead in the opinion polls and promising to prioritize the role of science in policymaking, some of these researchers hoped for a return to the days when the United States was viewed as the purported best place to do their job. Benjamin Sanderson said Europeans claim climate science in their continent is not treated as a political topic, adding that he also would consider returning to the United States under an administration that valued scientific input. In the United States, the role of scientific research in public policy is clearly on the ballot in the 3rd of November presidential election. Some Republicans have sought to undermine the research showing human-caused climate change since long before Donald Trump was elected in 2016. But the sidelining of science-based recommendations in policy decisions has only accelerated since. Against the advice of researchers, Donald Trump announced plans in 2017 to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord, an international accord to fight global warming. Trump claimed the pact would devastate the economy without providing much environmental benefit. His administration has since rolled back more than 100 environmental protections it deemed burdensome to industry, including those seeking to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Donald Trump has also appointed industry insiders on climate change or climate change doubters to key roles overseeing environmental regulation and cut scientific advisory committees at federal agencies. The politicization of science has come into sharper focus this year amid the coronavirus pandemic, as President Trump has ridiculed and ignored many research findings and recommendations from the administration's top infectious disease expert, Anthony Fauci, and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. According to an August statement by the Union of Concerned Scientists, a non-profit organization that advocates for scientific approaches to social and environmental problems, the U.S. administration has made a habit of ignoring, sidelining, and censoring scientific researchers. White House Office of Science and Technology Policy spokeswoman Jordan Hunter did not comment on the departure of scientists under Donald Trump or on the administration's handling of research on climate change and the pandemic. She claimed the administration was committed to ensuring the next great scientific breakthroughs happen in America, such as artificial intelligence and space exploration. Joe Biden, by contrast, has promised to fight climate change and to use scientific research and advice to tackle the pandemic. The Biden campaign said his transition team is already seeking input from informal advisors on how to rebuild and expand U.S. research. Transition spokesperson Cameron French said science will be at the heart of a possible Biden-Harris administration. The candidate's contrasting takes on the value of science may be best summed up by Donald Trump himself, who said at an 18th of October rally in Carson City, Nevada, "If you vote for Biden, he'll listen to the scientists. If I listen to scientists, we'd have a country in a massive depression instead of we're like a rocket ship." Biden replied the next day over Twitter, "For once, Donald Trump is correct. I will listen to scientists. Make the planet great again." In December 2017, French President Emmanuel Macron offered alarmed U.S. climate scientists multi-year grants to relocate and conduct climate research in France under his Make Our Planet Great Again program, a jab at Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan. The program came in response to Donald Trump's decision to begin withdrawing the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement. According to the French government, at least 32 scientists from across the globe took Emmanuel Macron's offer. About 18 of them had been working at US-based institutions before they moved some or all of their research to France. Benjamin Sanderson had previously worked on projections for extreme weather related to climate change at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. He said he moved to the French city of Toulouse to escape the politics that has engulfed U.S. climate science. He said he works primarily in the hope of informing policy, an endeavor that was no longer relevant under the Trump administration. Another scientist who went to France is Philip Schultz, a former postdoctoral researcher at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. Now he studies organic electronics and solar energy in Paris, under the French program. He cited the Trump administration's climate skepticism as driving his change of job and country. Philip Schultz said, "I work in a field that is trying to combat climate change and enable an energy transition." While some U.S. scientists took up Emmanuel Macron's call to work in France, others fled jobs with the federal government for positions in academia, or for left-leaning state governments such as California, which tried to recruit disgruntled researchers. Jared Blumenfeld, California's Secretary for Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, who ran the federal EPA's Pacific Southwest region from 2010 to 2016, said, "I feel they're like Russian dissidents during the USSR," adding, "they've been in exile in California." Blumenfeld said it will take decades to rebuild science from an onslaught of politics and superstition he believes began under the administration of Republican George W. Bush. He said California will not begrudge researchers who return to federal government jobs if Donald Trump loses the election. He said if they want to go back and continue to work and build up these battered institutions, Godspeed, adding, we've been here to take them in from the storm. The U.S. government scientists and experts have found refuge in academia. Joel Clement, a former director of the Office of Policy Analysis at the U.S. Interior Department, left government in 2017 after being transferred from a position focused on climate change in the Arctic to the department's Office of Revenue. He now does research and teaches at the John F. Kennedy School of Public Policy at Harvard University. Joel Clement, who has been involved in conversations about restoring U.S. science with other experts informally advising the Biden team, said any administration is going to have a long road to get this back on track. Dr. Ruth Edsel, Environmental Protection Agency's former head of children's health, is still working at the agency, though she says she has been sidelined from her specialty under President Donald Trump. A pediatrician with a focus on epidemiology and preventative medicine, Edsel was placed on administrative leave in 2018 after advocating more aggressive measures to prevent lead poisoning. She now works as a senior advisor in the Office of Water. Edsel said, I don't have meaningful responsibility in Office of Water. She said she hopes in new administration she would let share her expertise. The Environmental Protection Agency declined to comment. The Biden campaign hopes scientists who left come back to work for the federal government. According to advisors who were not authorized to speak publicly, a campaign working group has been tossing around ideas for restoring scientific integrity on Zoom calls, including possibly creating a White House office focused on climate change, setting up nonpartisan oversight of federal scientific agencies, reappointing scientific advisory panels, and recruiting young scientists to federal jobs. Climate scientist Ben Katramani Balaji, who is working as a laureate in the French Make Our Planet Great Again program, but kept his affiliation with Princeton University in the United States, said such changes would be very welcome. Balaji said, at some point, science is going to be invited back to the table, adding, as a community, we need to be ready for when that happens. Moreover, from travel bans to human spaceflight to the coronavirus pandemic, U.S. President Donald Trump's policies and actions have changed science. Since he took office in January of 2017, Donald Trump has not made science a priority. He has proposed massive cuts to many science agencies and took 19 months to nominate a science advisor. But his policies and actions have had strong impact, many of them harmful, on researchers and issues relating to science. A travel ban. In just his second week as president, Donald Trump signed an order that prohibited people from seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States. The order sparked fear and confusion, including among researchers from those countries and their collaborators. After several legal challenges to various versions of this order, the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately upheld a more limited version of the ban. Science spending. The administration's first budget proposal for 2018 calls for slashing funding for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, the U.S. National Institutes of Health, and several other scientific agencies. The U.S. Congress, which decides spending levels, largely ignores the proposals, but the administration's spending requests signal its priorities for science funding. In the same month, Donald Trump signed an executive order that aims to dismantle the climate policies of his predecessor, Barack Obama. The order directs the Environmental Protection Agency to repeal limits on carbon emissions from power plants. Moon plans. Donald Trump directs NASA to work on sending astronauts back to the moon, signaling a change in priorities for the agency. The administration later puts a 2024 deadline on this goal, which would be within Donald Trump's second term in office if he is re-elected. Data ban. Scott Pruitt, appointed by Donald Trump to the post of Environmental Protection Agency Administrator, proposed a rule that would prevent the agency from basing regulatory decisions on studies for which the underlying data is not publicly available, which includes many studies that rely on medical data, such as those on health impacts of pollutants. Nuclear withdrawal. Donald Trump announces that the United States will exit the nuclear agreement with Iran, a move criticized by many researchers. Delayed advice. Trump nominates meteorologist Kelvin Drogemeier as his science advisor. The president took longer to appoint someone to this position than any other first-term president since at least 1976, when the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy was actually created. Industry tilt. The Environmental Protection Agency proposes changes to its process for evaluating chemicals that would put greater weight on industry-funded research. Advisors cancelled. U.S. researchers decry a decision by the Department of Defense to cancel its long-standing relationship with JASON, an independent group that provides technical advice to the government and includes many eminent scientists and academics. Sharpiegate. President Donald Trump falsely claims that Alabama is likely to be hit harder than anticipated from an approaching hurricane, and his administration criticizes National Weather Service forecasters who contradicted the president. A government investigation later finds that the administration's actions could undercut public trust in Weather Service forecasts. Viral misinformation. Donald Trump tells the country not to worry about the coronavirus because it is mild and like a flu. However, in recorded interviews with journalist Bob Woodward that weren't released until September, Donald Trump admitted that the virus is far worse than the flu virus and that he intentionally played down the threat to avoid creating a panic. Blaming the World Health Organization. With the US coronavirus death toll rapidly climbing, Donald Trump blames China and the World Health Organization WHO and vows to freeze US funding to the agency. The president hypes chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine as treatments for COVID-19, despite questionable evidence that they help. Subsequent studies show no evidence that the drugs are effective against the disease. The Environmental Protection Agency proposes to maintain current standards for particulate air pollution, dismissing evidence from government scientists and outside researchers that strengthening those standards could save tens of thousands of lives each year. Vaccine race. Donald Trump announces Operation Warp Speed, aimed at producing a vaccine against the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 by the end of 2020. Donald Trump declares that the United States will withdraw from the World Health Organization, WHO. The CDC sidelined. The Trump administration transfers responsibility for collecting coronavirus data away from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, part of a series of steps that sidelined the agency with primary responsibility for preventing and responding to disease outbreak. Testing confusion. The CDC, the Center for Disease Control, issues revised guidance suggesting that people without symptoms do not need to be tested for COVID-19, sparking anger and confusion among scientists and public health officials. Guideline reversal. The Center for Disease Control reverses the new testing guidance after reports that political appointees at its parent agency, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, had published them without proper scientific review. Donald Trump announces that a coronavirus vaccine will be ready by October, before Election Day on 3rd of November, prompting fears that the approval process could be influenced by politics. We'll be right back.
Iran Today.
Iran and America, once fast friends, turned foe 40-plus years ago with Iran's Islamic Revolution of 1979. But were they ever friends? Platonic friends on a par, that is. Iranians remember no less than some 60 years of bilateral underlying enmity, beginning with U.S. bullying.
How can you beat a bully? You can't very well be a bigger bully than the biggest, even if you want to. And that's partly why Iran was pulled towards an anti-imperialist revolution, and till today has resistance at the top of its agenda. But what made Iranians suspect America all those years ago before the revolution? And can a Democrat such as Biden make a difference all these decades later? To unlock closed doors and open a path for talks between Iran and the U.S. I'm Leila Faramayzi in Iran Today. A day particularly marked in bad blood between Iran and the U.S. is the 4th of November, or 13th of Aban on the Iranian calendar. This year it coincided with the 3rd of November, but it has been no less eventful. It is still the anniversary of Students' Day and the U.S. Embassy takeover in Iran. And in the U.S., it's marked Election Day, after debates between a highly controversial Republican and a level-headed Democrat. Mr. Sadatian is a U.S.-Iran affairs expert. It was a pleasure to hear him at Press TV Studios.
Iranians have never fully trusted the U.S. and its policies, even before the revolution. Why so?
Pessimism vis-a-vis the U.S. is mainly rooted in the 1953 coup against the Mossadegh government. Until that event, or up to World War II, the U.S. was not much involved in colonialism, I mean externally, as it had realized colonialist projects internally. But after that, it gradually found a black image in the countries where it interfered. The Iran issue is a case in point, as the Americans were duped by the Britons into getting involved with the 1953 coup. Many related events followed, including Nixon's visit to Tehran and the death of Iranian students. That, along with similar incidents, made Iranians pessimistic about the Americans.
I've also another U.S.-Iran expert here with the right brain cells for a logical analysis of interstate relations. That would be Mr. Abolfat.
The Islamic Republic of Iran took great strides to reach an understanding. It even ignored its demands in order to reach a win-win deal, but the Americans broke their pledges, as the Europeans have acknowledged it. Furthermore, the atmosphere of mutual confidence built at that time was damaged, while it could extend to non-nuclear issues too. Therefore, the Islamic Republic of Iran had no other option than resistance. It was Iran's sole choice, particularly after Mr. Trump came to power. Maximum resistance against maximum pressure.
November the 4th, 1979, is a symbol of the confrontations between two forces in the history of the Islamic Republic. The founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, was exiled to Turkey on November the 4th, 1964, for protesting the Shah's affiliations. Dozens of Iranian students were killed on November the 4th, 1978, before the revolution, in protest to U.S. affiliations at home. And finally, the capture of the U.S. Embassy was on November the 4th, 1979, year of the revolution. This was the end of the counter-revolutionary actions of the embassy in Iran. When Imam Khomeini was faced with the action, he referred to the embassy takeover as the Second Revolution. The celebration of this day, Students' Day, is a celebration of the efforts of a country that has aspired to stand against the desired order of a superpower. Interestingly, Donald Trump also chose the same day in 2018 to reinstate sanctions on Iran.
The Americans maintain that Iran disrupts any order. The US is a superpower and has spent $8 trillion realizing their regional ambitions. Thousands of US servicemen have died in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars in order to restore order. The Americans say Iran complied with the world order up to 1979, but it turned to revolutionism afterwards.
Referring to his opponent, Biden, on the question of whether level heads might think for themselves henceforth or continue to be guided by policies set by their predecessors, as has been the case with U.S. presidential successions, our next guest says, let's see what Mr. Ojorlu has to say. He's editor-in-chief of the political magazine Mosallas.
It would be both correct to say it would make a difference or would make a difference. You may ask why. It's because of political psychology, policy making, international relations. That would make people and parties different from one another. A case in point is the difference between Obama and Bush Jr. So was the case with Bush Sr. and Bush Jr., Mitt Romney, Colin Powell or McCain would be totally different from Trump, were they elected president? However, they are the same regarding the Americans' objective of containing Iran and causing the country to change its behavior.
Democratic presidents of the United States have evidently not refrained from any blows against Iran. The string of sanctions Iran's post-revolution history has been decorated with were colorfully named by Republicans and Democrats alike. Executive sanctions against Iran began with Democrat Jimmy Carter. Clinton later took important steps to hit the Iranian economy with his unprecedented sanctions. The Obama administration, especially Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, was at the forefront of all U.S. administration sanctions against the Iranian people with painful sanctions. Suffice to look at her book, Hard Choices, and see how she committed herself to cutting off Iran's oil, or lifeblood. She made every effort to build an international consensus against Iran.
Would it make any difference to Iran if a Democrat such as Biden got in or a Republican such as Trump?
Donald Trump and Joe Biden could not be viewed as totally different. Both may create opportunities and threats for the Islamic Republic of Iran. We cannot say Biden is good and Trump is bad. If Biden comes into power, he would create both opportunities and threats for Iran. So is the case with Trump. If he's re-elected, the current sanctions will continue to remain in effect. However, Trump would also create some opportunities for Iran without really meaning it. Therefore, we cannot say this one is good and that one is bad.
We must not forget that in the 8 years of Obama's presidency, Joe Biden was the first vice president. In fact, the sanctions Trump reinstated against Iran were mostly imposed by the Democratic administration. But with Trump re-elected, things could get a lot uglier than the economic war on Iran, which is sanctions.
We are resisting here while Trump continues to stick with his policy of applying maximum pressure on Iran. That may lead to military confrontation. If it happens, it would create tensions in the region. Some nations are trying to prevent such confrontation, but Trump has shown in practice that he will continue with his policy if he wins the election.
It's a wonder how the U.S. administration has gotten its people to believe the pursuit of Iran and wars on West Asia are worth the trillions of dollars it spent. Regarding Iran, Mr. Biden will continue the path of trying for talks and playing the sanctions game, according to Mr. Sadatian.
If Mr. Biden is elected, Democrats would opt for multilateralism in regional talks with Iran. But Mr. Trump would resort to bullying and force to impose his own views on the Islamic Republic. But Iran has so far resisted and refused to buckle down.
The
the U.S. Embassy, 50 years ago, been state-of-the-art telecommunications machines. Speaking of which, people in virtual media networks and different media outlets today have been talking about one presidential candidate over the other. Who would make a better U.S. president, in other words, for solving the crisis between Iran and America? Iranian politicians, however, believe it makes no difference whether a Democrat or Republican are in power in America, because U.S. foreign policymakers don't understand the importance of Iran in the region and try to control it. They still try to control it, and this is a policy shared by Democrats and Republicans. The only difference is mostly in their rhetoric. Whatever one might say of the Democrats, Republican Trump got to represent the same party that led the United States during the Iraq-Iran war. We do know that Reagan, U.S. president at the time, did not withhold any assistance to Iraq and against the Iranian people. It is now clear that the United States knew at the time about Iraq's chemical arsenal and Saddam's intent to use it, and even knew where the targets were. At the same time, the United States attacked Iranian ships in the Persian Gulf dozens of times.
The U.S.'s foreign policy relies on two pillars, building consensus and stirring intimidation. Some U.S. administrations, like the Trump administration, are focused on intimidation. He believes that the U.S.'s economic power would make the world obey its orders. He doesn't care about the world's reactions. He's assured that foreign companies would not cooperate with Iran. That is the intimidating aspect of U.S. foreign policy. If we assume Biden to be willing to continue Obama's policy, the U.S. would turn to consensus building once more. He will join global coalitions, improve ties with the European Union, and make efforts to satisfy China and Russia.
To the Europeans, the good thing about it is they don't want an absolute breakdown in Iran.
One reason why the Europeans are defending Iran's cause is that if Iran is weakened too much to reach implosion, a power vacuum would be created, which would cause chaos and repeat Iraqi and Syrian scenarios in Iran. The consequences would be very much heavier than earlier thought.
Mr. Salimi Namin is a historian with an interestingly different but convincing understanding of occurrences to what I'd learned before.
We were a nation with empty hands, but we pinned down the Americans. Before the Islamic Revolution, we had no arms. But after this nation strengthened its determination to end the U.S. hegemony, it succeeded. Today we are highly capable. We can overpower the U.S.'s most sophisticated weapons in the region and discredit the U.S. technology. With such a potential, we can naturally resist the U.S. bullying further.
Should the U.S. succeed in taming Iran, would it not be catastrophic for this region? I mean, it doesn't seem to be so obvious to our neighbors, who are actually shaking hands with Israel today.
The U.S. has long focused on two issues in the region, energy security and Israeli security. Relying on these two strategic issues, the U.S. is justifying its presence in the region. Following the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the Americans have felt a threat to the Israeli security on the part of Iran. The Islamic Revolution accelerated the trend of revival of Palestinian ideals. It also revived Muslim dignity and independence. It also offered a new and reasonable interpretation of nationalism and territory.
Going back to the earlier days of the Pahlavid Shah Mohammad Reza, a newly modernized developing country like Iran would have to choose a side between the Eastern and Western superpowers of the Cold War era. And while the Soviet Union merged nations into its ideological bloc, the U.S. indirectly colonized them with the promise of sharing in economic prosperity. Even if not fairly in an equal partnership with the U.S., sovereign borders would be respected. But our historian here decisively objects to what he sees as a delusion.
When France was to sign an agreement to develop subway stations in Iran, the U.S. ambassador opposed and the agreement was not signed. On the nuclear issue, the Americans were opposed, even to the research plant. You must know that France was giving Iran the technology. It was the Soviet Union that gave Iran the steel technology. The Americans refused to provide us with the steel production technology that was the motor of all industries.
That is not the only reason why many an Iranian has suspected the honesty of U.S. policy for decades before the revolution even. It began with what's known as the 1953 coup that toppled the oil nationalization era Prime Minister Mossadegh. Of the other prominent reasons for Iranian distrust, some are Iran's adoption of the capitulation bill, which went on from October the 13th, 1964 to November the 4th, 1964. It was brief, as it was an intervention both the administration was largely reluctant about and the people were infuriated by. Next is the U.S.'s endeavors to cause the failure of the Islamic Revolution. The highlight would be January the 28th, 1979, after the U.S. realized that Iran's new governing system would not be bent into the ally it had hoped. Third would be the U.S.'s provoking separatism among ethnic groups. We are referring more to 1979 to 1980. However, that's a ploy the U.S. inherited from European powers of past. Fourth would be the U.S.'s issuing of resolutions against Iran and sheltering the Shah or deposed king in 1980 for cancer treatment. I leave the most current reason to return to in a bit. Before getting back to where we were, I give you Shahrzad for a look at what other media outlets have to say.
Hi, my name is Shahrzad Manoucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on Iran's successful resistance against the U.S.'s bullying. In an article by the Rusi, we witness Iran and the U.S., the long and arduous diplomatic road. Under severe economic pressure, the Iranian government is not about to collapse. To the contrary, having survived the worst of the U.S.'s maximum pressure attempts, it is showing a certain degree of confidence in its own resilience. Economic pressure is devastating in the long run, but Iran can live with it in the short term. Furthermore, Iran now sees China and Russia as providing it with a border strategic option, a prop to rely on at the UN, and a counterbalance to U.S. and European pressure. It is true that Iran has remained in the JCPOA in the hope of fully restoring it. Still, there is a faction in Tehran, which is quite vocal in the parliament, that wants Iran to leave the JCPOA and even the non-proliferation treaty. Furthermore, even among those who support the JCPOA, there is still significant worry about Biden. Their argument is just as Obama used his popularity with Europe and was more successful than Bush in increasing sanctions on Iran, Biden too can gain European support in isolating Iran. The Financial Tribune reports Tehran will not surrender to American demands. The United States' purpose is to impose its strategies and policies through pressure, but the Iranian nation will never surrender to U.S. demands, a top general said. They want to bring Iran to the negotiating table, and the result of these negotiations has already been determined as Iran's surrender to the U.S., which is never in accordance with our country's morals, Chief of Staff of the Armed Forces Mohammad Bagheri said in a video conference in Tehran. By accepting the JCPOA, Iran compromised with the world and agreed to reduce part of its tasks to enjoy a reduction of sanctions. The whole world admits that Iran adhered to its commitments, but the U.S. non-adherence complicated the affairs, Bagheri said. Iran waited for a year, but then adopted a policy of active resistance, according to the general, by focusing on self-sufficiency. Merit News Agency claims Trump's insult will unite Iranians against U.S. bullying. Calling Trump's insults as a sign of anger over the ineffectiveness of U.S. foreign policy, the chairman of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations said, "Such moves will make Iranians more united in resisting U.S. bullying." Kamal Kharrazi made the remarks in reaction to the recent anti-Iran insults of the U.S. president, adding Trump's insulting words are a sign of his anger and dissatisfaction with the ineffectiveness of sanctions and the failure to achieve U.S. goals against Iran. Not only such ill-mannered behavior will never help the U.S. to achieve its goals, but also it will make Iranian nation more united in the path of resisting U.S. bullying and unilateralism, he said. The U.S. has intended to bring Iran to its knees through imposing new sanctions and redoubled pressure, he said. He added, the main U.S. policy towards Iran is the maximum pressure that the result of which was U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA, reimposition of anti-Iran sanctions, and assassination of General Soleimani. That's all for this segment. We'll see you next week.
The last reason I'm here to give for Iranian suspicion towards America is the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, which appeared to be a center for espionage and conspiracy. We're talking the 1960s and 70s. That's what led to the embassy staffers being taken prisoner by students who had stormed the embassy. They were set free 444 days later on January the 21st, 1981, just hours after President Reagan delivered his inaugural address. This incident may be what cost Jimmy Carter a second term as president. So Iran may complain about the U.S. interfering in its affairs before the revolution and trying to rein this country in since the revolution. But whatever policy the U.S. adopts towards Iran reflects back on itself. Perhaps that is why America thinks or appears to think that Iran interfered with its 2020 elections.
In the contemporary history, the trend has been reversed for the first time. It was the Americans and Britons who decided who had to become prime minister in Iran. But now, Iran is accused of interfering with the U.S. presidential election. The claims that Iran is sending emails are untrue, but the fact is that we are influential in the U.S. election. I mean that many of those who are fighting against racism in the U.S. are inspired by the Islamic Revolution.
Now I have spoken for reason for Iranian suspicion towards America. The Iranians, with their long history, are tolerant and understanding of political turbulence. But the Iraq-Iran war and how the U.S. aided and abetted the aggressor Saddam Hussein against Iran are cause for hatred even.
Rivalry and even conflict between Iran and the U.S. may lie under the same opposition to a political interpretation of Islam. In the other words, since before the end of Second World War, we saw Islamist tendencies with political approaches in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood. We see it even during the constitutional revolution in Iran, Sayyid Jamal Asadabadi. A sort of return to self or religious revisionism was crystallized in the Islamic Revolution, and Imam Khomeini symbolized protests against the political, economic, and social system.
U.S. aggression aside, the lack of affinity between the two states is actually natural, going by the nature of Iran's political constitution post-revolution. This can be summarized in one aspect as follows. Iran's effort to become a free, independent state based on the Republic and Islam versus U.S. attempts to return Iran to being a country serving the West in any way possible.
We're faced with the reality. The U.S. does not like Iran as it is now. The U.S. expects fundamental changes in Iran in order to allay its pressure. Mr. Pompeo has said on several occasions that Iran should become a normal nation. What they mean is something similar to pre-revolution Iran or some regional nations. Due to such problems, Iran's efforts to allay pressure have failed.
And as long as it deems necessary, Iran just won't say yes to no resistance. After years of U.S. sanctions, interference, and espionage. In fact, the room behind me is where U.S. diplomats held their secret meetings. Talking of sanctions have in fact made Iranian rulership's rhetoric more decisive. They are now talking of industrial independence, not just from the West, but also from Iran's own oil economy. The economic blow that Iran suffered through the oil embargo, among other things, showed the Iranian authorities more and more that they must free the country's economy from dependence on one type of income. Iran once showed in facing Obama's sanctions that it can withstand such restrictions. On the other hand, Iran's self-reliance with this process can become a model for other countries.
The U.S. pressure campaign has not been successful. The Iranian economy has not collapsed. Iran's regional and defense policies have not changed. Iran's JCPOA approach has not changed either. Iran has even distanced itself from hazardous nucleus materials. But the Trump administration thinks differently, and its aides say the pressure campaign against Iran has been successful, and Iran is on the cusp of change.
Iran's resistance caused an awakening among other regional states, and this turned into an axis of resistance. Bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
France has been involved in a number of illegal invasions and interventions that feed terrorism in both France and elsewhere in Europe. France also took part in the invasion of Afghanistan, whose destabilization has played a prominent role in radicalizing many Afghans. France, along with the United Kingdom, led the charge in the destruction of Libya. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by staff of Fast News Agency published under the heading, France Brought This Unto Itself. Stay with us for more of the Fast News Agency article. Thousands of people from all walks of life in the Muslim world, Europe and elsewhere continue protests over the French President Emmanuel Macron's silly vow to protect the right to publish blasphemous caricatures against the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and Islamic beliefs and values on the pretext of freedom of speech. The tensions between France and Muslim nations flared up this month when some blasphemous images were republished by the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo to mark the opening of the trial over the deadly 2015 attack against the publication. As expected, this angered Muslims across the world who considered depictions of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, blasphemous and outright wrong. French Interior Minister Gérard Damanin has warned there will be more attacks as the country is placed on maximum security alert following Thursday's deadly attack by a knife-wielding man who killed three people at the Basilica of Notre Dame in the southern city of Nice. France's maximum security alert level means repressive measures will be carried out, such as arrests without court warrants, police raids on premises, and the blocking of websites with anti-establishment material. French President Emmanuel Macron, who has called the deadly stabbing a terrorist attack, announced that there will be increased surveillance of churches and military patrols on the streets of France. Troops guarding the streets have been bolstered in number. One could say this is discriminatory and a violation of human rights. No doubt, if it was another country putting troops on the streets and marking warrantless arrests to stop anti-establishment protests, the West would rally against it. For France, however, these measures come too late for those who have already lost their lives due to terrorism and Emmanuel Macron's anti-Islam rhetoric and policies. France did the same thing when it helped the United States invade Iraq on the pretext of destroying Saddam's non-existent weapons of mass destruction. As such, France knew the claims were geopolitically motivated, but it did send troops to Iraq to take part in one of the greatest human rights atrocities of this century. In sending troops to kill the Muslim population and get away with human rights violations and crimes against humanity in the name of bogus war on terror. What is going on in France is in fact similar method to what the French did employ in Iraq. Take for example, French troops are placed on the streets of Paris and Nice after protests linked to the publication of cartoons and Emmanuel Macron's hate speech on the pretext of freedom of speech. The terrorist attacks that have taken place in France, whilst tragic, are a drop in the ocean compared to the thousands of state-sponsored terror attacks and bombings that take place in Iraq, Syria and Yemen on the pretext of democracy building and war on terror. The fact is, a Muslim person's life is just as valuable as a French person's life, and the Muslim governments have just as much responsibility to protect their citizens as the French government has to protect its citizens. Thanks to the bogus war on terror by the United States and its duped allies, including France, the endless war has set up education centers for terrorism, and Wahhabism is not just in West Asia region, but in Europe. This is no different to France, which in 2016 opened its first de-radicalization center in Pontourny for its own young people returning from Syria. Originally, the French government, who believed that over 9,000 people in France had been radicalized in Syria, planned to house many at these centers, known as Centers for Prevention, Integration and Citizenship, to complete a 10-month curriculum. However, in France, the centers, which were voluntary, had been a disaster because few were attended these centers. The fact is, those who slice off innocent heads in churches and the US-led government that who butchered citizens in Iraq, Syria and Yemen in the name of freedom of democracy believe their actions are justified. As such, they do not believe they are morally responsible under international laws. This means they will not voluntarily attend a course to change their views, nor will they ever end their endless war on terror in the West Asia region. France has been involved in a number of illegal invasions and interventions that feed terrorism in both France and elsewhere in Europe. France also took part in invasion of Afghanistan, whose destabilization has played a prominent role in radicalizing many Afghans. France, along with the United Kingdom, led the charge in destruction of Libya. It was French President Nicolas Sarkozy at the time who made it his mission to gather an international coalition to wage war on Libya. France is also engulfed in the mess that is Syria. While being against President Bashar al-Assad, France has simultaneously bombed civilian targets in Syria. France's foreign wars and interventions have destabilized West Asia region and Europe. This has led to refugees pouring into Europe, which has in turn undermined the stability of the European countries. The atrocities in Iraq, the atrocities in Afghanistan, in Libya and Syria are human rights disasters that are unmatched and unprecedented. France brought universal damnation upon itself.
Decision 2020. Educational institutions in the U.S. were supposed to represent equality of opportunity, but there are still persisting inequalities at the heart of America's educational system. Hundreds of thousands of American students have been exposed to gun violence during school hours, and there has been a large number of deadly shooting incidents at American schools. Experts have also labeled the issue of student debt. That's a big problem. It's called a national crisis at this point, which is dragging down the economy, fueling the racial wealth gap, and even destroying lives. Then teachers, they're frustrated. Although their job comes with unique challenges, the majority of them earn a solid middle-class wage at best. Hello, and welcome to Decision 2020. I'm Kavit Athley. Yet unfortunately, the topic we've covered in this program, like the U.S. educational system, is not the one being covered by mainstream candidates.
In the United States, the school system is viewed as an educational ladder, a concept used by the Americans to reflect the value of individual success and the equal opportunity for working one's way to the top. However, although the Civil Rights Acts of the mid-1960s eventually ended, the legality of the infamous practice of school segregation and educational inequality in the U.S., students still receive dramatically different learning opportunities based on their social status. In many areas, the cost of education is rising much more rapidly than the average family income is. There are striking differences between white and non-white students' access to key educational resources, including skilled teachers, quality curriculum, sufficient funding, and essential classroom materials. Schools receive a large percentage of their money from local property taxes. As a result, the wealthier school districts offer better educational opportunities. Recent reports show that predominantly white school districts receive nearly $23 billion more in funding than other non-white school districts, despite serving roughly the same number of students. This shows that racial gaps in residential patterns are directly linked to educational disparities in the U.S.
A series of university research in the year 2019 surprisingly showed that New York schools are the most segregated in the U.S. That revealed that they not only isolated students by race, but also by their socioeconomic status. Let's hear more about that.
We have such a disparity between schools that largely serve Black and Latino populations and then the small number of schools that white parents tend to send their children to. And so I've been covering school segregation for a long time, but then had my own child who was 4 years old, and I was having to suddenly pick a school for her in this very segregated system.
Even if these schools were roughly equivalent academically, as that would still be a violation of the principle of Brown versus Board of Education that separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. But in practice, they are very rarely equal in any way. Black and Latino children are more likely to attend schools with inexperienced teachers, which are then less likely to offer a college prep curriculum. On top of which, because race and class are inextricably linked, those students are six times as likely to be in high poverty schools. And while there are teachers and students working incredibly hard in those places, they are often doing so with fewer resources.
Okay, I mean, talking about this in the year 2020 is quite incredible. All right, Nicole Hannah-Jones, author of New York Times Magazine article, Choosing a School for My Daughter, is what you heard there, along with John Oliver, just courtesy of them, in order to bring the point across. Well, having heard that, let's get our first guest in and hear the guest's opinion about the ongoing racism crisis that's happening at U.S. schools and the potential political solutions for this problem. James Brewer is an assistant professor of social foundations of education at the University of